You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for being here today. We're excited to have Denis Mesny with us today to talk about the recent protests in Brazil, which are now only about a month or so in the past. It feels like a kind of eternity since. It sort of all happened kind of fast forward time and over a very compressed period. At the time, and since then, I had a lot of bilateral conversations with many of you, and I know there was a lot of interest and sort of questions within the organization, and we wanted to take advantage of Denis's quick trip through New York as someone who both has worked in a variety of policy areas in Brazil for many years and has significant expertise in two areas that were in some ways at the heart, I think, of these recent protests, to share his thoughts on both sort of what happened, what implications there are both within Brazil, in terms of the type of work we as Open Society Foundations and Denis at the Lehman Foundation supports and focuses on, and then more generally from our perspective, how this relates to the similar but yet very different waves of social protest movements going on globally. Denis is currently the director of the Lehman Foundation, established by global entrepreneur Jorge Paulo Lehman. It's a foundation that focuses on improving the quality of education available to Brazilians. Previously, he founded and directed and is the chair of the board of Instituto Sol da Paz, an organization that's been a key partner for many parts of OSF, focusing on violence prevention, and has a long trajectory and expertise with citizen security issues in Brazil. Denis, it's a pleasure to have you here today, and we look forward to this conversation.
Great, so thanks, Eloisa, and thanks, Bipasha, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm very happy I'm starting this series. It can only get better, I think I should start with a huge disclaimer, which is, since I used to be a lawyer at some point, at least I got training, and I'm in the U.S., so disclaimers work really well here, is that I don't think I can, or maybe, well, I certainly can't talk much about what happened in Brazil in terms of a very bold analysis with a lot of, you know, reference and evidence, since we don't know. It's very early to tell. It's not clear if this is going to continue, if there are other things that can trigger similar levels of protest and engagement from civil society. But what I can do is share a little bit about what I thought about this and engage in a conversation with you and see what, if it is useful. I don't know how many of you are. I know some people here are very familiar with Brazil. I don't know if it's worth maybe doing some kind of a short recap in terms of where we are and what happened in the past 20 years.
Yes. And
I think that's okay. So we are in Latin America. No.
If we go very, very, very fast, then if we look at the past 50 years in Brazil, by decades, so that won't take very long. In the mid-60s, in 64, there was the military coup in Brazil. And the dictatorship was implemented and lasted until mid-80s, until 85. And in 64, so basically was the military coup. In 73 and 74, we had like the economic boom in Brazil, so in the middle of dictatorship, but there was an economic boom, building of major industries, industrialization in Brazil, and this gave the regime more time to grow. In the 80s, in mid-80s, again, going for fours to fours, as someone used another day in Brazil, and I liked. In 84, we had the biggest movement probably before the movement we just saw, which was but much more structured, which was called the Diretas Já. So it was the movement to end dictatorship and allow people to vote directly for a presidential candidate. We had been able to vote for governors since 82, but in 84, this big movement that made the end of this. From 84 to 94, it was basically so establishing democracy, but we had also at the same time hyperinflation, very, very dramatic economic conditions, and growth of urban violence also in the country. And in 94, we had the stabilization plan, the Real plan, that basically ended inflation. So basically, we can say that this period was between 94 and 2004 was the economic stabilization and kind of laying the ground for people to move to a different. So political stabilization between 84 and 94, 94, 2004 economic stability. And maybe between 2004 and next year was economic inclusion and out of, you know, moving out of poverty. 40 million people left poverty in Brazil. We are 200 million, so it's a big number, I think, in any case. But and kind of then you had like 20 years of the end of or almost 30 years after the end of democracy, after the end of the military regime. You had a political stability. You had opposition, and you know, transition to the opposition in 2002 very smoothly. A lot of the policies were kind of continued and kept, even if it was the biggest opposition, the PT, the Labour Party, against the Social Democrats. Inflation has been under control for again almost 20 years, and people discuss, and we have maybe a little peak in inflation right now, but it's nothing compared. We used to have 80% a month inflation in Brazil. And so now, I mean, and then you start having economic growth again, even if it's much lighter than people expected. And you have a lot of social inclusion and social policies lifting people out of poverty. So why did people go out to the streets in this scenario? And I think there are several, I mean, the factual, or it seems to be factual reasons, so again on the recap, were a group that is a group of, it's a youth group, not a social movement, not an organized, not the union, or the union, National Union of Students, which is organized, and so it's a group from outside the traditional social movement, the Movimento Passe Livre, who defends a free, the right for young, or the right of free bus transportation, basically public transportation, in the country, who had protested in the past, so we don't know why this time it really worked, but they went out against an increase in the price of the bus from 3 to 320 reais. And then it got much more media attention and much more people even in the first days than people expected, maybe because people are really fed up with the chaos in transportation in Brazil's big cities, majorly São Paulo, Rio, Porto Alegre. People were really feeling that this is really a critical problem, and we can talk why this is a critical problem. And then, but subsequently, there was a bigger protest, and this time the police was really, really, really brutal. And I think, I mean, the police being brutal in Brazil, it's not exactly a headline, but I think what changed was everybody was looking, and I think the fact that they got, I mean, this is my personal interpretation, the fact that the police hit very severely 7 Folha de São Paulo reporters. Folha de São Paulo is one of the major newspapers in Brazil, and it's funny how a big part of the more conservative media that was not clear if they were supporting or not these protests, when they got their journalists victims of the police, they really became against police brutality and for the protests. And the protest that happened immediately after that was really the biggest, 2 million people out on the streets, was when you see, like, it was every political, ideological view, I mean, rich, poor, everyone was kind of on the streets. And I think this was a combination of, you know, we want to speak, and we're not going to be stopped by the police on our right to speak. We don't feel that there are channels for our participation. And also, I think it became like, it made sense. I think we have been silent for a very long time in Brazil. I participated in the wave of protests of 92 when we basically impeached President Collor Gemello, the first elected, democratically elected president who was impeached because of what seemed at the time enormous corruption activity. Today, they've created new, records for that. But and I was part of it. I was a high school student. I was the president of the student association of my school. I was really involved in that, and it was really impressive. But if you think after that, so I come from this. So La Paz also started as a social movement. The NGO I founded afterwards. I started this on law school with a lot of people. And so having been on the streets for some time, it was really impressive how Brazilian civil society was quiet under the Lula years, let's say, from 2002 to a month ago. And I think part of this has to do with what we're living. I think there was a, during the Fernando Henrique administration, the Cardoso administration, which is the previous from 94 to 2002, you had a lot of protests from the organized political movements, which are always aligned to the Labor Party. So they were in opposition, it made sense. So all the unions, the major unions in the country, the student associations, the Labor Party itself, which used to be a very rooted down in society organization. So you had this, your protests against privatizing the Brazilian mining and rail system and communication system. You had protests against a series of reforms that were made in the 90s that were considered the neoliberal reforms. And you had a lot of what you'd say it's a more traditional. It's like the protests you see on G8 meetings or protests against, austerity, maybe different now. But it was kind of, so this was a tendency. And in 2002, I remember very well, there was a meeting of the Association of NGOs in Brazil. And they were discussing, what do we do now that we are the government? It was kind of a feeling that, there's the first left-wing government in Brazil. A lot of people from the more traditional rooted civil society and civil society groups, the landless movements and other movements, were kind of saying, finally we won. And a lot of them joined government, right? A lot of the leaders, like what happened, it's a huge exaggeration, so let's say, but let's use it anyway. Maybe like what happened after apartheid in South Africa, Mandela, I have colleagues working, and you work much more than, in South Africa, in the gun control movement, and they said that, in 94, Mandela is, the president. A lot of the civil society groups moved to government, and civil society first lost a lot of its leadership, and then doesn't know really, can we protest against the government? It's still very violent, there are still a lot of problems, there are still a lot of people in poverty, but I think there was, at the first stage, a vote of confidence, let's say in the early years of the Lula government, a big vote of confidence. But after that, I think that changed to a more, the government opened up to include civil society in the debate, but under a very traditional umbrella. And this umbrella was, organizing the conferences, as they call it, so health conference, communications conference, public safety conference. So these conferences were basically where you get elected officials from the civil society in municipal conferences, and then you go delegates to the state conference, and then you get elect delegates to the national conference, and those national conferences decide on a set of policies that are going to be implemented by a bipartisan, not bipartisan, but a civil society and government council on every major area, so on women's rights, on human rights, on public safety, But the problem is that this kind of model that started in the 80s in Brazil, and it was very unique in the 80s after many years of dictatorship, it really doesn't engage a lot of people. Engage people who have time and believe strongly that they should participate. They are funded somehow to be able to be in all these different levels. And a lot of those people are related to the Labor Party and were related. So it's kind of, you got a lot of the political party system inside the civil society, the spheres of participation. And with that, because the government had more money, Brazil was growing, the government had more money and was investing much more in social policies, you started having a lot of money going to NGOs from the government. But this was not as always. I don't know a government who, maybe there is other systems of funding civil society that, but at some point, this becomes a little, when government funding is your biggest source of funding, there is a risk that you're not going to go to the street protest against your major biggest funder, and that's probably true also for protesting against big foundations, talking from our side. Or I don't, there is something there, and I think that, and this again, it's very my personal analysis of it. I think that we lost a lot the capacity to go to the streets, and a lot of very bad things happened at the same time as very good things were happening in Brazil. So economic, you know, economy was going well. Politics against poverty were doing well, but we had a lot of problems in corruption. We had a lot of problems of public safety. We had a lot of problems on transportation, on education policies, and nobody was really saying something. So I think that when this happened in June was kind of, okay, we've been silent for so long that everybody wanted to shout and go to the street and say, there's some, and this became really the best way to what really became the brand of the Brazilian protests were the signs that, I don't know if you saw it, but like everyone brought their own sign. And it was really, after maybe the third or fourth, you see like common signs. But it's completely different than what I used to see in the students' movement. We'll organize, we'll debate heavily what we're going to write and each, and who's going to be holding, and you know where it should be, and this is our first key message, and then we'll put in the back maybe these other messages. No way. I mean, each one had their, and this is very, I mean, social media and the style that I don't need to really collaborate with anyone and discuss with anyone. I can just express what I think it's the most important thing. And you had a lot of very funny ones, and there are some websites collecting them, and it's a nice reading if you understand Portuguese. So I think that in this process that led to this big, I don't think there was a problem, but I think maybe the way to analyze this is really, on one hand, the lack of routes to participate, like lack of how could we communicate that we're not completely satisfied. It was too much stability, if we can say, like everybody very happy. It's a third term of the same party in government, which in Brazil it's a first, right? After a dictatorship, we don't have that many, but we have a lot of this in the state. If you look at the state governments, I think not many people are talking about that. Brazil is a federation like the US, we have 27 states. If you look at the state level, the political alliances in those to keep the mandates of to support governors, there is no opposition in any state in Brazil, mostly almost any state. And in Brazil we have, I think now, 28 political parties with representation in Congress and growing, because of course we have 28 very clear ideologies that we need to have a party to represent. So in our political system, it's a great thing to have a party. You know, you get funding, public funding, you get TV time, you can negotiate this TV time with the big parties, and this, the level of pragmatism that the PT, that the Labour Party brought to government, that said, you know, we finally won, we're not going to be the idealistics here, we're going to be pragmatic, and they went to a very high, very, very high level of pragmatism. So you look at the alliances, they go from the, that support Dilma, President Dilma, they go from the Communist Party to the, you know, PP, which is the used to be the right-wing party, all the, you know, traditional former military leaders, former, you know, President Collor, is on their bay, it supports them. So he was impeached by all these movements. Now he's a senator, and he is a supporter of the government with a relevant position. So you had kind of a consensus, a fake consensus that was built under a lot of pragmatism, and I think this exploded somehow. And I think the reaction from the streets was, social movements do not represent us, and I don't know how many of you saw that, but the social movements were kind of jealous of the protests, so they said, July 11th, we're going to stop this country. And why are you doing this? No, we're going to stop the country. All the unions got together, the students' movement, we're going to do this big, huge, and they announced this and announced it and put ads on the newspaper and we're on TV every day. Nothing happened. On July 11th, life was like completely normal, nothing changed. You see the protest, you see the leaders saying, we are millions here, and the camera would show like 300 people and here and 20 people on the other. It was really embarrassing, but it's a good contrast for what we're seeing of the traditional representation versus something new. And this something new, and I'll stop there, I think it's very difficult right now to define, and maybe that's where this connects with the other protests around the world and which I know of, you know, reading newspapers, talking to friends who are involved somehow. But I think there is a... It's clear that our current participation, civil society participation model is not working. It's also clear that we don't have a new one. And I think that that can explain the level of, I don't know, what's happening in other parts of the world where you had the protests, you know, some time ago. Things doesn't seem to change. You go back again. It becomes violent because you're angry and you want results. And everybody is kind of, we know that the younger, the new generation is much more like the ability to wait for an answer is, you know, maybe because everything is, you know, a click away, and if your internet is not like super ultra high speed, you're already like, oh my God, you know, and then you remember, you know, 5 years ago, what you need to do to find out about something, you know, the ability that we do, things are getting so much faster through technology. Things are getting so much, you know, it's the capacity to be individualized, personalized. That's how you listen to music. That's how you, you know, search on the internet. That's how you buy books. Everything is thought to be like very, very personal, and they have to recommend what's perfect for you and your, you know, for your next song or your next book or your next, you know. In education, we're seeing this trend of personalization. Everything. Politics is not personalized. You know, a public policy, policy debates, they take long time. It's difficult to get change. It's not going to be exactly what you want. And we saw in Brazil these protests. They want everything and sometimes contradictory messages. So I think it's going to be, we're going to live a period of transition from the traditional civil society that was definitely seemed like was going to die. And I think it's, we can say now that it's probably dead, the traditional model of representation and participation. But because this new model is not clear, that's why we're seeing a government that is this happening in Brazil and not in most of the countries who used to be dictatorships in North Africa or the Middle East. I mean, in Brazil, people responded. The president responded, went out there and said, you know, gave a statement, we're going to do this. Congress approved, like, they never worked so hard. Of course, they worked very hard, but they make sure that nothing is has the final approval. They approve in a committee, they pass another committee, they get a few headlines, then they, you know, stop and don't do it. A lot of the responses are not response. I would think it's are the best ways to respond to protests. A lot of that has to do with more kind of the mano dura traditional policies. So, you know, that's always there. But the fact is, even with a government desperate to answer the protests and willing to do something, it could be because they truly want to do a better government. It could be because they want to be reelected in October 2014. It doesn't matter. That's why we have elections. You know, it's for people to want to be elected and have to show results. But the problem is that you don't know. It's very clear that there won't be answers by then. And then what's going to happen? I mean, also very difficult with our current political system that you'll be able to have very different candidates emerging. And so it will be an interesting year from now to the election cycle in Brazil, and to see how, if this will come back or not. So I spoke more than I wanted, but this is kind of my first take on this.
Thank you very much, Denis. I'm going to start with a couple questions and then open up for questions here and in DC. The first is on this very issue that you focused on about how, in some sense, the traditional civil society organizations failed or were silent or didn't represent over these last few years for a whole host of reasons with the role of the Workers' Party and being in government being kind of at the center of this. For you, does this affect or have you thinking about the work you do day to day at the Lumen Foundation? Should it affect for the partners we work with in the various areas, citizen security, education, human rights, public health? And if so, with the caveat that we all have, this is very new, we're just starting to think about this, but what is it that we should be thinking about in our days to day as sort of the professional civil society?
So I think this is a great question. I think if you asked me this 2 months ago, I'd probably give the same answer. So I don't think it's
changed
because of this, but I think it definitely gives more weight to this is, I think we're in, and I think that's why the work that Open Society does is so important, is we need a strong, independent civil society, and I don't think we have one. Brazil, it's a democracy, you know, we have free press, we have a free judiciary. We're very, I mean, we're much better than many, many, many other places in the world. We just got these numbers yesterday, the Human Development Index, the local version of it in Brazil, went from 0.49 in 91 to 0.72 in 2010. That's a major growth. It's considered to be already on the high level. You have like hundreds of cities in Brazil which are on the very high level. So, I mean, things are definitely improving, and I think we live I think it's a solid democracy in Brazil. I think it's, we can say that with all the problems that we have there. But I think we still need a more independent civil society. And by independent, I mean one that is able not to live with a lot of very, very concentrated. We don't have a tradition of giving in Brazil. So you don't have a lot of private social investment. And when you have in Brazil, most of the foundations are, they give their money to themselves in the sense that they do excellent projects, but they implement their own projects. They're not grant-making foundations. But even beyond grant-making is like really building civil society participation. And I think this is really relevant for a country. If we were having this conversation maybe a year ago, we would be saying, you know, Brazil in the global scenario, Brazil is a future power, and today people are saying, oh, everything ended and the economy is not growing anymore and inflation is at 6.5%, so that's a disaster because it should be at 4.5. And you know, so I think people overreact towards Brazil in general, like it's either it's very bad or it's amazingly going. But anyway, I think Brazil is in a trajectory to be more important. And I think not having a strong civil society is not good for Brazil, and it's not good for the world in which Brazil is going to be a relevant player. Maybe it is already, and it's probably going to be much more in the next 10 years or 20 years. So, but also, I think that this means supporting traditional civil society groups, yes. But also, I think from the funders' perspective, from supporters' perspective, it's rethinking also, helping civil society rethink its role, and what are other kinds of participations and other kinds of groups who normally wouldn't get access to more traditional funding processes. They wouldn't get from government, but they wouldn't get from the more traditional funders as well. And Brazil, I think, in human rights, public safety, some of the, apart from education, where, you know, not because of us, but because of a series of organizations, there is much more funding available in Brazil. In most of other areas, there is not much private funding available. And I think also there is another thing to be worried about. I remember when I graduated law school 15 years ago, to work for an NGO was something kind of new, but was a great substitute for being a member of a political party. Right? Before, if you were an idealist and an activist, you would, your only way was to go to a political party, because people are already kind of saying that all political parties are all corrupted and they are not serious and there are so many internal politics, and that, you know, you found a way by being engaged in the civil society movement and being able to find funds for that and build it, that you are active, you're able to make a difference in society. But I was always in the civil society movement, always saying this is a risk for political parties, because we're living the room inside the more traditional political processes for professional politicians in a bad sense of the word. And this is happening, right? You see at the last elections in Brazil, how many serious people were elected? Very, very few. And less people are willing to be candidates, because so it's a vicious cycle that gets in order. And I think now this is kind of happening with NGOs. When you talk to 18, 19-year-olds, people who want to change the world, they want to create a startup or a social business. They don't want to create an NGO, or most of them don't want to create an NGO. And I think that also is, there is the new wave of people coming, they want to operate in a different logic. That's still, it's not proven yet. Nobody knows if this, you know, social businesses we try that also at the foundation. We support for-profit organizations as well as not-for-profit, but it's not really, it's a trend more than is a proven. So I think there are a lot of challenges for people wanting to support, but what it's clear is we need to be doing more. We need to reach to broader audiences who want to, you know, participate with different models. And we also should probably be thinking at the institutional level, engaging with governments and with other people. Because I think that whenever there is something so, I mean, I think every politician in Brazil wants to rethink the system with one hand because of they saw. On the other, they say, you know, if this system is kept, I'll be reelected. So I'm not going to, and this is why a lot of people call, including the president, for a public, you know, an open referendum or for people to be able to participate directly and decide on the political system. But even if that happens, what are the propositions on the table? How much people know about that, about representation? How many other ways of being represented we have? So I think we need, also in terms of the intellectual part of it and in terms of the exercises of thinking, more about other ways of participating. And how this can, you know, from social media to real public policy, and knowing that this takes much more time, it's much more complex, but we cannot ignore that these people are the ones, you know, demanding. So I have no answers, but I think we should be thinking seriously about it.
Thanks. Let's open up for questions and start here in New York, and then move over to DC.
Hi, thanks for talking with us. My name's Kate. I work in SCDF. I had two questions. Sorry. Sora's Economic Development Fund. I had two questions. One was on the social media piece. Could you kind of comment on what social media was being used? Was it Twitter or Facebook or a local something else locally, and maybe even, I this is such a millennial question, but which hashtags are being used and how people were using the media to kind of rally in a different way? And then my second question was on inequality, and is what's going on similar to what's going on in the US with a growing system of inequality? And could, is that what's playing out? Is it similar to here? Those are my two questions. Thanks.
So I'll start with the second. It's exactly the opposite in Brazil. So inequality is being reduced for the past 10, 12 years and in a steeper growth now. And so inequality is being reduced. And the analysis there is Brazil moved in the past 30 years from a relevant rural population to a almost totally urban, huge metropolis, more access to consumption and more access to participating in the market, more access to education since the mid-90s. Every kid is in school on age 7. So these, a lot of things happen. And I think now people want more. It's kind of the opposite of we used to have and now we want back, or we're seeing this. It's kind of, you know, we got these basic things, but we don't want the basic things. And I think once you have life, you want quality of life. I think this is, and we see this in São Paulo. São Paulo went through a huge reduction in homicides, right? Over 80% reduction in 10 years. We still have a lot of problems in property crime, but homicides were really, really, really down. And after that happened, it was very clear that the debate was, nobody was celebrating that they were not dead, right? You don't celebrate the fact that you're, well, I'm 17 and nobody killed me, woo! You know, it's you start say, okay, now, you know, okay, this is our baseline now. The baseline is a decent, maybe 8-9 homicides per 100,000. It should be less, but Chicago is 15. So, you know, I think we're good. But we should be going lower and lower and lower. But, you know, people want more. And we saw that in public safety when we had to move at Solda Paz, and they're doing this shift, looking from crimes against life to crimes against property. Because when we started, it was impossible to talk about crimes against property. It seemed just wrong. But now it's quality of life is living in a city where there's no risk of someone putting a gun to your head to get your, even if they're not going to kill you, to get your watch or your purse or your cell phone or whatever. That's relevant. It should be not part of your day-to-day. So I think this is so, because inequality is going down, because things have access, people have access to better education, better, they want more. And I think part of it has to do with education. Everybody's in school, and the first generation who was in school, 100% of its generation went into school in 97, 98. They graduated in 2010, 2011 from high school, and they learned nothing. If you look at the data on education, 5% of the people graduating high school in Brazil, 10% of the people graduating high school in Brazil know what they're supposed to know in math, and 50% of them don't graduate because they drop out of the system. In the US, where there is the education crisis, it's 25% drop out. So it's 50%, and it's growing. So I think a lot of people, this is a good example again. You had access to education, everybody was celebrating, their parents didn't have access to a free public education, but the quality was not there. And I think it's the same with health and the same with other areas. So I think it's that the reaction is people want more. And because it's less unequal, they want to participate fully and they want to demand more from government, because also more people started paying taxes, more people started participating in the formal economic life, and they moved from an informal job to a formal job. So it's citizenship. You want your other side of it. The first part of your question, I mean, the local social network in Brazil is called Facebook. No, it's Facebook with a Brazilian accent. So everything was on. You had some Twitter, but I mean, Facebook, I think, was the number one. I was just last Sunday in a public park in São Paulo, and there was a vendor, very informal vendor of beer. So it's like not exactly so. And she was talking to another vendor and saying, "Oh, you didn't put this on your Facebook, on your Facebook. Well, how come?" So we have 70 million Brazilians on Facebook, which is huge. So I think this is where. And the hashtags were very fun, but a lot of it in the beginning was, it's not about 20 cents. So it's not about the 320, you know, from 3 to 320. So this became very much the motto of a lot of this. It's not about 20 cents. And it's about political corruption, it's about participation, it's about quality of health, education, right? And a lot of things were related to the World Cup. The World Cup is taking place in Brazil in 2014, and we had the Federations Cup, Confederations Cup in 2013, and all the billion-dollar stadiums that were building 14 of them in Brazil, they were ready, and they were beautiful, and people say, you know, how come we invested that much money in building a stadium and not in, you know, so everybody was, there is this FIFA pattern, for those of you who follow soccer. FIFA is the Federation of Football, and they have, you know, this has to be a FIFA-approved stadium, right? So a lot of the debates were, no, you have to invest more because you have more, need more place between each one of the fans in the stadium. No, you need this, you know, so this was the FIFA pattern. And a lot of the hashtags were like, we want health, padrão FIFA. We want education, padrão FIFA. And I think that makes sense. It's like you're seeing this, and this was also a big part of the Brazilian propaganda. Like, Brazil is now perfect because we're hosting two of the biggest events in the country, in the world, the World Cup and the Olympics, the Summer Olympics in 2016. We just had the Pope, as I think lots of you saw. So we were having like these huge events, and people were saying, we're putting a lot of money in this, and this is not actually helping my life, my quality of life.
Start here. Thank you. This has been quite illuminating. One of the things that I noticed just in following the headlines that seems to be consistently the case in many of the protest movements that we're seeing around the world is this increased involvement of the middle class. And it seems to be in Brazil especially, the middle class is growing very quickly in the context of the economy growing and the higher development. And like you said, they're feeling empowered to ask for more. Where do you see one part of the question is, what was the role of the middle class, and how do you think that participation sustains itself, or what do you think will end up being the new face of not civil society but civic engagement when you have previously perhaps apathetic populations becoming much more involved? And then the second part of the question is, in numbers, in June we saw a lot of people mobilize, but do you think there's something that sustains this? You know, it could be that the government wants to react quickly because they have an election coming up next year. But do you feel like this is really a sea change? Is this really something that's a culmination of all of these factors that you've been putting together, or do you anticipate it will die out? So you know, it's not just a civil society question, it's also, I guess, the future of civic participation and how the government feels empowered to respond.
I think, I mean, it was very much a middle class. I have a few issues with the middle class thing in Brazil, everybody, you know, because if I would tell you how much the middle class person makes, you wouldn't call them middle class in the U.S. But this became like, oh, we have this new middle class. It's called the new middle class. But so they have much more money than they used to have, so I think that's okay. But it's we're putting the middle very, very... It's a big middle, let's say. It's not the 50% line. All that said, I think that it was middle class, and I think somehow it was always middle class plus more organized movements. So, of course, there was not middle class movements in the landless movement or in the Sem Teto, but you would probably have a few middle class people there helping with, you know, funding or organizing somehow. But in some of it's very base, like used to be very, like, you know, the church movement, this very grassroots, landless movement, very grassroots. But I think that in this new, the faces you were seeing were more of, you know, a lot of people were people, it's funny because they had these polls on the, during the protests, and like, you know, you're protesting against the price of the bus, do you take the bus? And, you know, huge percentages don't take the bus, don't take public transport, because in Brazil it's very much a class thing, right? You have a little bit of money, you buy a car, and you're out of this nightmare of the public transportation system. But then again, now you're in the nightmare of the individual transportation system, because you cannot move your car. So I think I think it's a good thing that a lot of people kind of question the legitimacy of the movement because there are a lot of middle class. You're going to say, but this is... And I think the second wave kind of protests were more like a lot of conservative middle class, and that got the traditional... it's like when you go to these islands, paradisic, you know, these beaches, like a paradise beach, nobody went, and then 10 years later it becomes a trend. And when you go with your friends, you say, like, well, but I used to come here when nobody knew about this. In Brazil, this is very big. People love to say that. And like, oh, no, but I discovered this place first. And there was kind of a feeling of the traditional human rights activists, traditional people, activists saying, oh, but I was protesting. Like, I came in the first protest. Now, this is not the real thing. This is not, because you see all these rich kids around, and they're not the true protesters. I think this is just wrong. I think, you know, the more the merrier. I think it's good that everybody is putting their heads there. And I think on your what's going to happen, I think it's very hard. I think the conditions that allow this to happen are unique in one sense for that specific days of, but again, I mean, the overall condition, the structural conditions are there. So I think that it should come back. I think the problem now is that we raise the bar, right? So in order to make the headlines, you see, in Rio, it never stopped, right? In Rio, it continues because they found out the governor uses the government helicopter to go to the beach, and the helicopter takes his dog to the beach, goes first, and then take his nannies, the nanny of his kids, you know, goes earlier because things like that. And so people are kind of, so in Rio, it continues, but it continues with a much smaller group. But because the media bought into it, it seems to be like, every day, every day, every day. And so I don't know if we're going to have millions of people again on the streets, but I think people are going to like to protest a little, and we'll have to see how this plays out. I mean, there is the level of violence right now. There's much less people on the streets. The protests who continue, you have a group of people who are not there. I mean, their way of protesting is really putting things on fire and breaking and destroying, and this will get, I mean, people will react to that, and we'll see how much the discourse for controlling of the police brutality will last when you start seeing this. So I think there are a lot of challenges, and I think the next political cycle will be a good test.
Hi, I'm Mark Kropansky with the Justice Initiative. Thank you very much. I think there's a lot of thoughtful takeaways for me here. And I had a question on policing. So it's a good segue. You know, as you mentioned, the significant spike in the protest numbers did occur after the kind of increased police repression and violence. And as you know, with Brazil, the Brazilian government is really developing a new global model of this kind of militarized policing, as we see in the lead up for the World Cup and actions taken in the favelas as well. So I was wondering to what extent that you've seen, from your impression, the calls coming out from the demonstrations really link the police violence during the protests with the everyday policing that's taking place? And then to what extent or what do you think that the future leaves for police reform in Brazil?
So I'm less optimistic on that front. I mean, the police in Rio killed, I think 10 people. I'm embarrassed not to have the exact number because it matters, but because I'm not working in the area every day. But it killed, like, I think 10 people on the Maré, on the favela, in, like, 2 weeks ago or something, right? And there was some protest because this was linked with the protests and police brutality on that context. Everybody, and now people are, they keep discussing what's happening in Copacabana and in Leblon, the rich areas of Rio, when there are these protests against the governor and the police is being brutal, so that keeps on the media. The talks about the 10 guys who were killed at Maré, nobody talks about that. There was this detainee that people said the police in Rio said they had like 20 Molotov cocktails around. They didn't find any, and who carries 20, but anyway. This gets a lot of attention because it happened in a rich area where everybody is looking. And this was always the case in Brazil. There was reaction against police brutality when it happened in Avenida Paulista and São Paulo and in the beaches in the south area of Rio. There was never a sustained reaction when it happened. So I think overall we're less tolerant to police brutality, much less tolerant than we were 10 years or 15 years ago, but I'm not seeing a shift in this in the way like opinion leaders and the big media looks at police brutality. And I think now when there's this violent groups that are continuing, there was a big, like, Global TV, the biggest TV network in Brazil, was transmitting live the day of the biggest of all protests in Brazil and seeing millions of people here in Brazil and they are peacefully, and they were live. And then these people started breaking down the Minister of Foreign Relations and they were still live. And they had like to, oh, but this is a minority, this is a small group, we have to continue. But you see like this was growing, and I think this is now, because there's much less people, you really see a few people protesting and a few people breaking everything that they see. And so I think the pressure on police to be the traditional police that defends property and the elite, I think this will come back. So we have to be very careful. I think the good thing is that we're seeing a lot of the police chiefs in the cities with they already had a much a better discourse, and I believe in this. I think this is an important part. And a lot of them are saying, we need to learn how to deal with that kind of demonstrations. We used to have, when there was demonstration in Brazil, we used to have one leader who would agree the, you know, where are we going to go? These are going to be the streets, so we can protect that. We can work with transit authorities to kind of put traffic. Now they can't because there's no leader, there's no, this idea of no leader, no agenda, no, this made the police very, very uncomfortable. So I think the police also was ready for democracy 1.0 and they're not ready for democracy 2.0. But at least they are saying we are not ready and we're trying to be ready. So in Rio, what they did last time, and I think it was moderately successful, they put the military police inside with the people, not like a big group on the sides or something, or in front. They just put, you know, a few there. So if there was a problem, and the problem, I don't think they are not doing this like a political, it's not free speech. It's really, someone is breaking, of course there are errors there, and they have like this huge bulletproof vest with their big, like an identification number that is much bigger than the traditional, like name tags that normally they, you know, they don't really use on this moments. So they're trying to give signs. I think if they learn with that, I think this is going to be useful, because as we are, we need to rethink how we work and everybody needs, I think the police needs to also rethink how they deal with that kind of protesting. But I think I don't think the police being military, called military police in Brazil, is the problem. I think that because they're called military police, we focused a lot on the military police, but they are not part of the army. They are, they respond to the governor, they respond to a civilian commander for many, many years in most of the states in the country. So I think we're having much more success reforming military police in Brazil than we're having reforming civil police in Brazil, which is the other branch of the police, which is the most corrupted and inefficient, and it's really the root of impunity and abuses and torture, and a lot of it, it's the civil police. And we're not looking at it because it's called civil police. So it seems like, okay, this is very democratic, it's the civil police. The problem is the military police. Sorry.
Hi, Sanjay Patil with the Public Health Program. So two questions, one picking up on the public safety theme and one more sort of international. With the public safety, in terms of time, if I'm not mistaken, there were a few violent rapes on buses prior to the main June protests, and I was just curious whether, given that they were protesting the fare increase, whether public safety found its way into the discourse surrounding the protests. And the second question relating to maybe not similar, but protests happening in Turkey and in India that are also sort of touching on sort of governance issues and also roping in previously silent protesters into the main mass of the movements. I'm just curious whether any commentators in Brazil are making parallels between what's happening there versus what we've seen in Turkey and India.
Yeah, so the first question is, I didn't see a connection. Maybe in Rio, in because that's where it happens, if there was a bigger, but I didn't see much of a connection there. The second question is, a lot of people compare, especially Turkey, because it was happening kind of at the same time, and I saw one analysis that I thought was interesting. Again, I cannot judge. Trying to understand, I mean, in most of the countries where, maybe India is another exception, I know nothing about what happened in India, but when you look at Tunisia and Egypt, and when you look at, you know, a lot of it had to do either non-democratic countries or in Europe had to do with the worsening of the economic conditions and unemployment and the austerity policies. And in Brazil, we are not living, I mean, we're starting to have a few economic problems, but it's really, really early to say that this was we still have, I mean, the lowest unemployment rates we ever had in our history. Brazil has 5.5% unemployment right now. It's really it's the level that you need to kind of, it's normal. It's to get the economy, so this is not there. Democracy is not being questioned in Brazil, so there's something there that is probably unique about this. What I don't think is unique is who's on the street. Is people had more access to information, more access to participation in other means, who are seeing a world that responds faster in their day-to-day life than the traditional world responds to politics and wants a different relationship with public policies and are demanding. But it seems like if people were demanding more democracy, like basic democracy, in other parts, in Brazil, it's like another level of participation. But again, it's hard to say right now.
Hi, Christine Sason in the fellowship program. So you actually just answered a lot of the questions that I was going to ask, which was regarding the comparative angle. You had spoken earlier on about the differences, I think, between civil society mass mobilization models and how it's different now than it was in Brazil 20 years ago, and it's also slightly different than what we saw in the Arab revolutions. And you just now spoke about, I guess, the different reasons behind it. So in that sense, would you say the protests that we see in Brazil are fairly unique in pretty much all other respects?
We love to think of ourselves as unique in
Brazil. I set that one up for you.
Yeah. We also love to think, say, we are the biggest in something, and the number one in something. Normally it's violence, corruption, and
soccer.
But
soften. Yeah, we're trying. It's getting better. We'll see now. You'll see if Brazil loses the World Cup. But no, it's funny how in the middle of soccer, in the middle of a soccer competition, all these happening was very refreshing for Brazilians who always kind of, we have people only care about carnival and soccer in Brazil and show that this is not the case. I don't know if it's unique about Brazil. I think the common trend, I know nothing about this. The common trend I try to see is this need for immediate response, or this, there are several researchers on the millennial behavior saying it could be in jobs, it could be in university, it could be that people want like things to happen much faster. They have no patience, people get bored very fast. In the kind of level of connectivity and level of multitasking that the new generation is used to. And I'm not saying this is the real, but I think it has something to do there. I think there is a lot of things that matter in your day-to-day life cannot be solved in a click. And a lot of other things can, like in Brazil at least. I mean, if you see the penetration of technology and even poor kids, a lot of things are being solved very fast, and some others are not going to be, but they're taking so long. I don't know if it's unique. I think there's something there that the use of social media and the use of all that should mean something. At least means that the level of decentralization that we're seeing in everything else in society, and it starts on the classroom where teachers used to be the sole source of knowledge, and now you have this, you know, internal revolution or crisis inside school systems where people are saying this model does not work, this is so fake, and education is failing almost all over the world. With very, very few exceptions. And you know, a lot to do has to do with the same model that was in place. And in other areas, I think there are a lot of crises between what we used to think was the best possible way of dealing with a problem and what seems that, you know, need to be the best way of dealing with a problem. So I think there is this reorganizing of expectations and of answers that we need to give. And the other fact that maybe in Brazil was not unique was that people had enough and they wanted, and I think this was a common, I think in Egypt clearly, you know, people had enough of, you know, the same policies and government and control and they went to the streets to protest that. I think in Brazil, in a very different scenario, because of the things I said earlier, I think people were, there was this feeling of, we said what, you know, we were listening, and this empowering thing for everyone. Kind of, people were kind of, normally when you have these protests and it ruins like traffic and people, you know, normal, regular people say, oh, this is, you know, baderna, this is a confusion, this is, and people were not saying that. People were really excited about what you see, 89% of Brazilians on the last poll supported the protests. 89%? Like, all of us who are activists, how often do you have 89% of support for anything except the opposite that you're protesting against, right? It's very, very rare to be, like, a huge majority of the country saying, even with all the things that were broken and, people are saying, yeah, this is, and the level of, also, how low is the index of approval of everyone in the public officials in the country? So I think there is something there in terms of that probably is not unique, that, you know, we just, and then how will this, is it enough? We said, we, you know, everybody is afraid. The president gave like 150 different answers. Congress did 300 different answers because they were on the race. Would they feel, and they will stop doing it, or maybe a year from now, they will come back to the streets and say, you know, nothing really changed, but we don't know that yet.